I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, Unhappiness in America. Our guest has done research focusing on the deep divisions in our country, not just in terms of income and opportunity, but in terms of hopes and dreams. The highest costs of being poor in the U.S. are not in the form of material goods or basic services as in developing countries, she says, but in the form of unhappiness, stress, and lack of hope. And what's most surprising, the most desperate groups are not minorities who have traditionally been discriminated against, but poor and nearly poor whites. And of all racial groups in poverty, blacks are the most optimistic about their futures. Carol Graham is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and College Park professor at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. She's the author of The Pursuit of Happiness Toward an Economy of Well-Being. And she has testified in Congress several times and has appeared on many, many news outlets. Carol, we thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Fine, other than writing on unhappiness rather than happiness these days, but
I know,
fine.
I know. Well, maybe the next one's just unhappiness and where we find happiness and what it is, what countries in the world have done something about this and how we should emulate them, huh?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, I don't think government should be in the business of, you know, worrying about making people happy or unhappy, but I do think the metrics and the data give us big insights into how people are living, and the countries that do best tend to be countries with, they're not necessarily always very wealthy, although they're not poor countries, but they're countries with good social safety nets, good environment, democracies, economic, you know, sound economic fundamentals. And then so we find that in typically the happiest countries are the Scandinavian countries, mm-hmm. some of the European countries. The U.S. does okay, but not so well given the big inequalities in happiness that we have. So we score lower than our income levels predict we should score. And then the many Latin American countries score much higher than their income predicts they should be. Costa Rica always tops the charts. And if you've ever been there, it's not only beautiful, and you know, they take a lot of care for their environment, but they've made a big, huge commitment as a society to invest in everybody's health, everybody's education,
mm-hmm.
And so that's made a big difference in terms of how coherent they are as a society, and how healthy people are, and how happy people are. And then they're also just the last point, because I think it might be relevant to my findings on the U.S. is that there are cultural differences in the way people answer surveys. They're just cultural differences in terms of how cheerful and optimistic people are. And Latin Americans in general are very cheerful people, mm-hmm. Just naturally optimistic. I was born in Peru, and I can attest to that.
Oh, you were.
And Central Americans even more so than South Americans. But I think, so what you get often is some interaction between, you know, cultural and individual level optimism and then what's going on environmentally. But clearly, absence of good social support, good safety nets, good public health, good education, and absence of economic opportunities are all really terrible for well-being. And I think that's what's driving the very stark trends in the U.S. In fact, I know that's what's stark trends in
and
the
what
U.S.
And what is surprising, and I must say I was surprised when I read this in your work as well, that the groups that we think are really disadvantaged, they've been discriminated against for years in this country, and they're mostly minority groups, but the groups who are really faring badly when it comes to happiness are poor whites in this country. That is really interesting, and you write that blacks are the most optimistic about their futures, and there have been some gains in their lives, in the quality of their lives over the past few years. It's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it?
It is, and I have to say, when I first started to write this book and look at the data, I was very, very well aware of the big gaps between the poor and the rich in the U.S. in terms of the kinds of lives they led, in terms of optimism levels, in terms of belief in hard work. Lots of things that were coming out in my early looks at the data and in my early looks around, you know, just anecdotal and reading. But when I got in to the data and started to break up the findings between, you know, I was finding very big gaps, not only in life satisfaction, but in stress and worry and markers of ill-being across the poor and the rich in the U.S. I broke it down. I wanted to know what was going on by race and place, basically. And so I was broke down the poor cohorts into poor blacks, poor Hispanics, and poor whites. And this is at the time of Ferguson and the riots in Baltimore.
Yes.
And a lot of concern, genuine concern, obviously, about the state of what was going on with certain cohorts of African Americans in this country. And I got my data showed, this is in, you know, fancy multivariate regression analysis, that poor blacks had this very high optimism coefficient, or, you know, factor in the equations, and poor Hispanics were, as I thought, reasonably optimistic, and poor whites were terribly pessimistic. And I had to, you know, go back and check and make sure this was not a data problem. And then I started speaking to people, you know, much sociologists, much more in detail about what might be going on. And then the other thing that was a huge, if depressing, complement to this finding was the data on mortality rates going up among uneducated middle-aged whites due to preventable causes came out. And that so confirmed what I was finding in my optimism data. And then, in addition to that, if you looked at what was not just what was happening to mortality among poor whites, but what was happening with poor blacks and poor Hispanics, which you cited as you introduced the whole show, their gaps between, you know, poor Hispanics and poor blacks and all blacks and all Hispanics in terms of mortality and whites are narrowing significantly. And there's other progress. There's progress in terms of narrowing education gaps. I don't want to paint a rosy picture, but it very much explains what's going on, which is you see cohorts who were traditionally disadvantaged making progress. It's gradual. It's not, you know, sometimes it's one step forward, two steps back. Sometimes it's better than that. But the data on all these markers show progress, and the data on what's going on with everything from skill gaps to health and mortality indicators to, you know, employment rates show that poor whites are falling behind. That, you know, so they not only are facing more competition for less good quality jobs or even bad quality jobs, just basic, you know, stable blue collar jobs, but they fear falling behind, and they have genuine reason to do so. So it's a bit of a shock to think about, wow, should we be worried about poor whites versus the cohorts who have been traditionally disadvantaged? And I don't think we should choose an either or, but it certainly was an eye opener for me.
Mm-hmm. So there's something about, let's talk about what's happened with employment. The poor, you say, in the U.S. are less likely to believe that hard work will get them ahead than are the poor in Latin America. Is that partially because there's been a real change in the jobs that are available? You can work really hard, but you're making a whole lot less than maybe your parents did when they were in manufacturing work or work where you didn't need a college education. Is that part of the equation, or is it something else?
That's a big part of the equation. So let me focus first on the U.S. in answering you, and then I can tell you a little bit about what is going on in Latin America, which is a more positive story. But yes, there are less stable blue-collar jobs. That's partially due to technology-driven growth. It's just the way the world economy is going. It's tectonic plates are shifting, and it's very difficult to fix that in any way. Right? We need to navigate it better than we're doing, but that's just a reality. It's easy to blame trade. It's easy to blame immigration. But the big movements in terms of what's going on with employment and inequality really have to do with just the nature of the world economy. And if you need higher education and often even higher levels of education to do well, and then you do very well. But if there are less low-skilled jobs available, they're of less quality, and they're more unstable. And so what we find is, yes, poor whites are comparing themselves to parents who did better than they. Maybe, you know, maybe they had one less refrigerator or one less car, but they had much more stability. they had much more status. You know, and poor blacks and poor Hispanics typically are comparing themselves to parents who are worse off than they were,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got very different psychological phenomenon going on. And at the same time, we know that people are much more bothered by losses than they appreciate gains in terms of economic sense, a well-being sense. Losing is, you know, falling behind, losing is much more negative for people's well-being, for example, than getting ahead a little bit.
And so, if you're stuck in a situation where you've got one of those jobs that doesn't pay as much in a higher education, if you have a higher education, you're going to do a little bit better, but you don't have money to go to higher education because you don't have a job that allows you to save any money to get a higher education. So you're really stuck, aren't you?
Right. And the other thing that's going on is a geographical story. Mm. So if you look at the mortality rate data and also what we find in our well-being data, is that the places that are, even though, you know, trade and immigration and all these things get a lot of play in the press and in the political debate, if you look at the places that are really desperate, where mortality rates are highest, where the middle class is really hollowed out, and where jobs have, you know, sort of job prospects have fallen the most, they tend to be isolated rural towns in the Midwest, the sort of the heart, mm-hmm. the heart belt of the country. And they typically are actually overwhelmingly white. There's not a huge amount of ethnic diversity, but they're often, you know, one industry towns. So if the big, you know, Walmart or the manufacturing firm or whatever it might be pulls out, there's nothing there. And the geographic isolation also has to do a bit with the setup of those places. Due to climate and distance, people drive everywhere. You know, they're strip right. malls or whatever, but there's nothing, there's no center of town that's vibrant. Interestingly enough, cities, which we know have problems with everything from gangs to, you know, the congestion and the crime and whatever that comes with cities are much more vibrant places, and mortality rates are actually lower in cities, and well-being is higher. And there's more diversity in the sense that if one firm pulls out, the whole city doesn't collapse. I mean, there's some examples like Detroit, which, you know, a little much more vulnerable to one industry. But for the most part, you know, big vibrant cities on the two coasts have their own problems, but they're much more optimistic places to live with more opportunities to get ahead.
But they're also much more expensive, aren't they?
Of course they are, but I mean, the ultimate expense right now seems to me to be, you know, living in a completely desperate place with high rates of opioid poison and suicide.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? So the problem there is that you were talking about not having the money for the higher education. You don't have the money to move. You don't have anything really to move to. So if you're in one of these places, it's incredibly difficult to pick up and move to New York. I mean,
right?
You couldn't do that. So that's a big part of the story, and it seems to, I think, you know, migrants by definition are immigrants or second generation immigrants are used to move. They've moved. They've done big, really difficult moves already, so they tend to be more mobile. They tend to be located in clusters, in places where there are, when they moved from wherever they came from far away to move to, they chose places where, one, there were usually clusters of people of their nationality, so they have social support, but where there was also vibrant economic activity and opportunities for low-skill jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of the story, of course, is that migrants typically don't crowd out jobs. They complement jobs. They do a lot of jobs that the classic unemployed white, I don't know, plumber or painter is not going to do. They don't go out and mow lawns if they lose their job, right? That's at least that's the basic data show. So you've got a story of sort of energetic, more mobile cohorts that are willing to do anything to move up, and a story of sort of a whole couple generation existence of living in some of these places that get hollowed out. And there is no tradition of moving somewhere else or retooling and doing something else. And, you know, the older people are, the harder it is to retool and do something else. And I think that's what's showing up in the middle-age mortality rates.
Yeah. And you're going to go to Latin America, where you would find similar small communities, I would think, where there aren't a whole lot of jobs, but much more optimism. Why? What's the difference, cultural difference?
Well, there are a couple of things in Latin America that really explain the difference. One is sheer economics, macroeconomics. It's a region that's gone through a lot of ups and downs, a lot of political ups and downs. And in the past two decades, with the exception of some countries like Venezuela, you know, that are clearly outliers, most countries have made serious commitments to democratic government and to prudent macroeconomic policy with things like independent central banks, which resemble our Fed, right? So, and you've seen swings. You've seen leftists. You've seen, you know, people center-right. You've seen all kinds of different kinds of politicians come in, and they don't mess with what's going on economically because it's working. They're managing their economies very well. So that's one part of the story. The second part of the story is that they have been very innovative with their safety net programs and their social welfare programs. Something called, or a set of programs called conditional cash transfer programs were pioneered in Latin America, and at one point Mayor Bloomberg was even talking about copying it for New York. We rarely look at Latin America for lessons, but maybe we should. And these programs are based on giving eligible poor, meaning below a certain level of income, poor households, a non-marginal amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not food stamps. It's an amount of cash that they can use to invest in or save for their children's education, whatever it might be. They typically buy food, and they're not going out and spending it rashly. But that assistance is conditional on their sending their children to school and taking them to the health post.
Oh, interesting.
So the rationale behind the program is that you are pulling people into society.
Mm-hmm.
We will assist you, but you are investing in your children's education and they're being productive members of society. And the other really important innovation is that it assumes that you, poor person A or B, are very capable of deciding what your needs are and that income is the most efficient transfer. In the U.S., we stigmatize the poor. We give them food stamps, which are, you know, stigmatizing and not particularly effective assistance. TANF assistance to needy families. Our cash assistance program has been falling dramatically in the past decade, particularly in Republican states. That's just part of the data show that. And the verbiage behind our assistance programs is very much, you know, you're poor because it's your fault. All of the political verbiage around support for welfare is very much, you know, if you're poor and you can't get a job, it's kind of your fault. It's
right.
Not that the system
right.
has failed. And the bureaucracies which surround the assistance programs are nasty. They treat people badly. They're inefficient. They're very bureaucratic. In contrast, the programs that are universal, Medicare, Social Security, they're semi-privatized. They operate very efficiently, and people don't even know they're on a government program half the time, at least with Medicare. So to get assistance as somebody who needs it here, it's stigmatizing. It's not sort of designed in a way to make people feel that this might help them become part of a society.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed to sort of say you failed.
Carol Graham is our guest this hour. Carol is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and College Park professor at School of Public Policy, University of Maryland. She's the author of The Pursuit of Happiness Toward an Economy of Well-Being. And she is talking about this wide and growing optimism gap that is open between poor and middle-class whites and their counterparts of other races. Why has that happened? And how bad is it? And how can more people be made to feel optimistic about their futures, with good reason. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we'll start taking your calls momentarily. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls for Carol, starting with Peter in Baraboo. Hi, Peter.
Hi, thank you so much. I want to commend the research done, and specifically the notation that in providing a basic annual stipend to people who then determine how best to use it, which has been documented to be much more successful, as your researcher has indicated, than the more punitive and questioning structure that we currently have. The second comment is that the structure that we currently have, which has become much more punitive, I was very interested to hear the researcher identify that these are mostly in Republican-controlled states and counties, and that this really needs to be reversed. We are, quote, the richest nation in the world. The question is how we choose to utilize that wealth. And part of that is to ensure that we have the fundamentals and the foundation in place to be able to support all of our people. Thank you for the show, and thank you for the research.
Thanks, Peter. Your response, Carol.
Well, Peter, I couldn't agree with you more. I think a couple of things to supplement what you said. The fall in social assistance, exactly, when you look at, in the decade that we had the economic crisis and very big increases in long-term unemployment, and while our employment numbers have risen at the same time, we know there are a lot of people out of the workforce who have just given up. I mean, that dichotomy is, I think, really just the wrong way to fix things, and we're seeing the manifestation and I think support for extremist politicians and all kinds of things that are just not healthy in terms of society. And in terms of designing social assistance, I don't think you necessarily need to copy Latin America's approach. I think there, maybe we should, I don't know, but I think that there are key elements of it that are fundamental and are really missing in our system. One is the sort of, as you say, just a lump sum of a meaningful transfer that people can decide how to use it themselves. If they can't decide how to use their own income themselves, they'll never get out of poverty, right? I mean, it's sort of, they treat people who are in need as grown-ups. And then at the same time, pushing them to are making that conditional on investing in their children and facilitating those investments with the assistance in terms of their kids' education and health, it's a no-brainer. I mean, compared to what we're doing now, in a very divided social welfare system with all kinds of different components, in the cross-states thing, just completely different state by state. That just seems to be, in the end, not working.
Carol, I don't think we've explained very fully, so let me ask you to do so, why it is that there is more optimism, an increase in life expectancy, and perhaps more jobs for African Americans who are poor in this country than for whites. What's going on in that community?
Well, optimism, let me start with the optimism, because I think there's a positive explanation and maybe one that's a little more reflective of the past. So the more positive explanation is that things are gradually changing. Maybe not perfectly, but they are gradually changing. And the levels of community support, the sort of that African Americans seem to have, sort of reported social support. My findings are controlling for religion. We know that the religious factor is quite high in many African American communities and contributes to this, but my findings hold religion aside, assuming that occurs, but taking that effect away, we still get this big optimism thing. So there is something about the kind of community spirit that's important. I think there's also, and granted, we're not talking about incarcerated young black males who are overrepresented in our prisons, and we're not talking about terrible inner city gangs, but, you know, on average across the country. So that's part of the story. Part of the story is that while there is still some discrimination, it's nothing like it was before. And so there, a lot of, I'm not sure that there are necessarily more blue-collar jobs available for African-Americans than there are for whites, but they're no longer barred from those jobs because they're African-American, right? Mm-hmm. So they can compete on a much more equal playing field. And there's some other things, I think, that we possibly, or that the kind of general media underestimates, but there's an African-American president who's been very successful, two-term president, who's a statesman who's had to deal with a lot of terrible challenges. And in the end, I think we'll go down in history with a really positive mark. And that, I don't think that's something that, you know, if you come from a group that's traditionally been discriminated against in this society, that's not a small factor. I think that's something important. So that's the positive side of the story. The more cynical explanation, and they're probably both at play, is that, you know, things have been so bad for so long that, you know, you adapt to things being bad and you retain your hope for the future. There may be some of that going on. I mean, I've certainly found, looking around the world, that people are amazingly adaptable. They'll adapt to a lot of challenges and maintain their natural optimism. And that's a really good thing, because it means that they will continue to try, right? But so there's both of those things that they may be going on at once. They're possibly competing explanations, or they may be complementary explanations. But I think that's also very, if the latter part of the, another part of the explanation, I'm sorry, is that if there is kind of nowhere to go but up, you know, you're making progress coming from a really disadvantaged start, that in general coincides with hope and positive emotions and positive levels of well-being. At the same time, the comparison group, right? Remember, this is optimism compared to poor whites. It's not some absolute measure. I mean, although we have absolute measures, but they stand out as very positive compared to poor whites. Poor whites are falling in status by so many different measures, both objectively, economically, compared to their parents, and compared to these other groups that are catching up with them.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Peter, for your call. We go to Charlie next. Hi, Charlie.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. I have a question and a comment. I live in an upper Midwest town of 2,500 people, and there's a program within our community and several surrounding communities where they've built housing and reach out to, you know, people living in poverty in other cities, including Chicago, and essentially give a voucher and, you know, open up the opportunity to move to our town, and basically, you know, are given, you know, open access where there's no jobs. I mean, I commute an hour one way to work. You know, I have a young son who just graduated from high school. No job opportunities for him. And I don't understand. I guess I just, you know, I love seeing my community become more diverse. I'm not anti-welfare by any stretch, but I don't see how it makes sense economically to do this. And it's basically, it's from what I know of it, you know, there's essentially welfare fraud going on at a very basic level. And, you know, I know somebody that works as a maintenance person for these buildings, and basically they get destroyed. Oftentimes kids get abandoned and the people go back, whoever they might be, back to Chicago and leave their kids unattended. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff going on a very deep level that is just like, you know, doesn't make any sense economically to me.
Charlie, what's the goal? Something happened to that phone. What's the goal of the program? Why are people being encouraged to come to your small town?
You know, I don't honestly know. I'm researching a little bit, or trying to find out more about it, what's the motivation, or what's the...
Right.
As far as I know, there's a money stream, or there's a program that's set up, and I think that from my understanding, you know, in order to keep the program moving forward and continue to receive funding, they need to fill these apartment units. You know, I have no issue with the welfare piece of it or anything like that. If people have a need and a genuine need, I have no issue
right.
with that. But I don't understand the
yeah.
So, okay, just a detail. So they're getting a voucher to have free housing? Is that what that is?
I think there's an initial voucher in support of possibly food. You know, I'm not exactly sure what that voucher piece, how that fits in. But,
yeah,
but
I think
they're encouraging them to move
from Chicago
to a
yes.
place where there are no jobs.
That's what it sounds like. But it sounds like we don't have enough details on this to really fully comment on it, do you
right.
think?
Yeah. No, I don't think so, but it does not. It doesn't sound like the direction of policies we want to emulate.
Right. Yeah. Thanks, Charlie, for the call. Richard and no, Mary is next in Amherst. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling. I am a public health nurse in a central Wisconsin county here. And I do work, the majority of the clients I work with are lower income whites. And what I've seen in just the course of the time that I have started working as a public health nurse, which is about 5 years, is how complicated things have gotten, especially for those that are not able to navigate computer systems, that don't have access to that. Often our clients, they don't have landlines, but they have cell phones. Many times when we're even trying to reach them for appointments, they don't have the minutes to accept the call. And so there's a lot of things that have happened in the system. And as we have become more and more interested in lowering taxes, a lot of the county-based services that used to be available are now regional. And so most of the access has become online. As even an older person who didn't grow up with computers, I find it cumbersome. And now there's always help at the county agency if people can get there, or to a regional agency, which is more difficult if they don't have access to a computer. They can't do things if they don't have an access to a fax.
Sure.
Then they have to come and fax all of these things. So sometimes when I look at the decline in numbers using the services and saying things are getting better, I just sort of think this has become very cumbersome, and people that are the least able to work the system, whereas if we are employed, we have a human services, human resource department that just takes care of so much of this for us. So that has become difficult. And I think also there has been, as our country has become more equitable, which I think is a very good thing. I think when sometimes, as your guest has spoken, when you are looking at things as optimistically, like opportunities are increasing, whereas many poor whites who did have sort of a racial privilege,
Yeah, I'm sorry, your phone totally faded out, but yeah. I think we have a good explanation.
Yeah, no, I think that, first of all, incredibly insightful
mm-hmm.
and helpful comments. See here, let me comment on two components of them. One is the whole issue of, I've talked about the unfriendliness of the bureaucracies and for the people most in need. And one of the things I've written about extensively in the past, mainly working on the poor in developing countries, not in the U.S., was how the opportunity cost of the poor's time is always underestimated. So the standard economics measure of how much your time is worth is based on what your wage rate is. So poor have low wages, so they've got all this time on their hands, or their time isn't that valuable. But that's not the case. The poor households struggle constantly. They're juggling a number of things to make ends meet. Most things are harder for them because they may not have a car. If they have a car, it's a lousy car and it breaks down. Getting to the appointment, getting to the job appointment, or getting to the health center, or getting assistance if you don't have a computer, becomes you know, an order of magnitude more difficult, and it takes an order of magnitude more time. And it's not a surprise that people eventually give up. Related to that is something that certainly I show in my findings and I've seen around the world, is that stress that's associated with circumstances beyond your control, you know, you constant negative shocks, the car breaks down, you lose your job, your kid gets sick, so you can't go to work, and then you lose your job. The sort of the classic and difficult story of being poor. That kind of stress leads to cognitive difficulties in planning ahead because you can't, you know, and after a while you don't, because you're, you know, it's sort of each day is such a struggle. And then a bit describes, you know, what's going on in the story that the caller talked about. You know, eventually, on top of everything else, if getting assistance is just such a sort of a bureaucratic, time-consuming, mm-hmm. and difficult thing to do, you give up. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what I think is going on with our whole approach to assistance that is really counterproductive. Secondly, though, she noted that our society was getting more equitable. Well, it may be getting more equitable in terms of racial equality, which is a great thing. But in terms of income inequality and opportunity, equality of opportunity, we have become the most divided society, short of possibly South Africa, on the globe, in terms of how unequal our income distribution is. And in terms of differences in opportunity, we are no longer the Horatio Alger society. We are no longer the land where everybody who works hard can get ahead, as those answers to that hard work question show. And one of the things that happens when you become so divided is that the lives of the rich and poor are so separate that one doesn't know how the other lives. Success for those at the bottom becomes increasingly unattainable because it's so far beyond their reach. And the third thing that happens is that families with means can invest so much more in their children from day one that even when you give poor children opportunities, say to go to college, if they make, you know, they do well in high school and you give them the opportunity to go to a really good college, often they get there and all the other things and experiences, from travel abroad to special music lessons, mm-hmm. to special whatever that the other kids have, are so far from their experience that it makes it difficult for them to succeed. And so inequality is a factor in all this story, and we've certainly looked across places in the U.S., and we find that in more unequal metropolitan statistical units, which are bigger than zip codes but smaller than states, so compare Appleton, Wisconsin to the Bridgeport, Connecticut area in terms of distribution of income, or Vero Beach, Florida, both have very high levels of inequality. And in these more unequal places, we find that life satisfaction is lower and stress and worry among the poor is much, much, much higher, because those very big divisions also result in big divisions in society more generally.
We'll pause. We'll return. Thank you, Mary, very much for your on-the-ground acute observations. Our guest this hour is Carol Graham. We're talking about The Pursuit of Happiness Toward an Economy of Well-Being. That's her latest book forthcoming. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and she is a professor at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. She's done a lot of study of unhappiness in America, and she finds that, and it's surprising, I think, the finding, except when you look at the rates of suicide and opioid addiction, which we've been hearing about recently among poor whites, that the highest costs, she writes, of being poor in the U.S. are not in the form of material goods or basic services, as in developing countries, but in the form of unhappiness, stress, lack of hope, and what's most surprising, the most desperate groups are not minorities who've traditionally been discriminated against, but poor and nearly poor whites. Of all racial groups in poverty, blacks are the most optimistic about their futures. Here's our phone number for you to respond, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to a couple comments here on Facebook and Twitter and all those places you get a hold of people these days. Someone from Madison asks, what about the new poor, the people with higher education who have been attacked by, this person believes, GOP government policies? Carol.
I'm not sure. Was that a question or a comment? I'm sorry.
Can you address the new poor, those who do have higher education but have not been able to find jobs?
Oh, yes. That's a generational. Sorry, I misheard you first. That's a generational story. And I think there what is going on is a whole generation that was affected by the financial crisis and the collapse.
Mm-hmm.
So kids coming out of colleges, including good colleges, who had invested a lot of money in their education, or their parents had. And there was about a five-year period where there just weren't jobs for that cohort. And, you know, one could say, well, now the economy is recovered, but they didn't have jobs for 5 years. They may have been backpacking, they may have been doing all kinds of other things, but they didn't have stable jobs. They weren't developing skills in the labor market. And so when the economy recovered, their competition for those for now new jobs are kids coming out of college who are equally skilled and probably cheaper to hire. So there's a cohort of sort of millennials who really lost about 5 years of skills, training, wages, and they fell behind, and their competition, you know, is as likely to get those jobs as they are, even though their competition is just out of college.
Let's go to Richard in Madison next. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm really concerned about the white poor, especially the males. I'm wondering why, with our infrastructure falling apart, roads that are undrivable, bridges that are unsafe, that we can't get a public works program like FDR created during the New Deal. And this doesn't require rocket science. Even I worked in a truck factory when I was a kid, going to college.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't have to be highly, highly educated. You can read a blueprint. You can do it.
Carol.
Well, I agree with you. You know, the whole idea that we could be doing much more for the people falling behind, and particular skill cohorts and everything else, with standard government programs that we used to have that operate in other countries has sort of flown by the wayside in a debate and, you know, deeply divided ideological debate where government is bad, social welfare assistance is bad. It's all about individual success. And, yes, if you succeed in this country and you happen to be, you know, lucky enough to have the education and the other associated privileges to do so, you can do very well. And I'm sure you have to work very hard to do so. But there are people that can't succeed in the current environment and could be doing something productive with that kind of program, right? And our infrastructure is falling apart. So I absolutely agree with you. This is it's not rocket science. And one of the things we know when you think about, you said you were particularly worried about poor white males, and we know a lot about desperation among that group and high mortality rates and high rates of addiction to opioids and all sorts of suicide rates, everything else. What we know from research around the world on well-being is that being unemployed, when, you know, you would like to be, when it's sort of your identity to be unemployed, to be a provider for a family, is one of the worst things possible for human well-being. Your purpose is taken away, right? And so having nothing in its place is terrible. I mean, it's bad for health, it's bad for well-being, and in the end, it's really bad for society and social
coherent.
It's good for people to work. Do you think that we do need, and we've toyed with it, when we had an idea of a stimulus program some years ago, and then that all fell apart, would you be in favor of some kind of massive public works program a la FDR to accomplish what Richard said needs to be accomplished, Carol?
I'm certainly not an expert on what a massive public works program would cost. There are many ways to provide assistance. We know our earned income tax credit program seems to work pretty well. You could imagine extending that to perhaps give credits to states who created public works programs or whatever that might be. That requires thinking from people who know how to design these programs more than I do. But I do think we need have to have a serious public discussion about the state of our society, the level of desperation in our society, and where we're investing things and where we're not investing things. And so, to me, it seems to be a plausible direction to go in, but I don't have the numbers attached to it to, you know, make any kind of informed, yes, this is the way we should go recommendation.
You write in the article that we read, and it'll be part of the book, when people were asked in these various groups what they expected their life satisfaction to be in 5 years, what kinds of possible answers were they given, or was it free form? Well, I expect that I'm going to be making twice as much money.
No, it's not free form at all, and that's why it works quite well in terms of robust economic analysis. They are asked to first, they're asked about their life satisfaction today on an 11-point ladder where the worst possible life they can imagine is 0 and the best possible life they can imagine is 10. And where do they think their life is? And then they are asked the same question, but where do you think your life will be in 5 years? So it really captures optimism, sort of, am I going anywhere? Will things get better in 5 years? You know, will my life satisfaction be better in 5 years? So it's a very simple question that's been used around the world, and it works very well, and the answers seem to track very well with objective indicators, such as, you know, the really low answers track with depression, anxiety, suicide, all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And high numbers track with more investments in the future, better health, all kinds of things. So that these perceptions and optimism questions actually play out in actual behaviors.
And when you say that the least optimistic group by far is poor whites, by how much? What's the difference?
Well, let me just give you an example. So, because you have to answer this in sort of probabilities. You can't just throw a number at it. But so, poor blacks are 3 times as likely to score 1 point higher on that scale than poor whites.
Mm.
Poor Hispanics are about 1.5 more likely, or 1.5 times more likely to score a point higher.
Mm-hmm.
And 1 point higher is a significant difference. It's only an 11-point scale, right?
Mm-hmm.
And along the same vein, poor blacks are half as likely to have experienced stress the day before than poor whites, and poor Hispanics are about 1/3 as likely to have experienced stress the day before than poor whites. So stress is another sort of parallel marker, which is, you know, not just about your situation, but how stressed you feel about it. And again, poor whites, so that the stress and the optimism findings mirror each other quite nicely, both in terms of direction and in terms of how their order of magnitude.
Carol, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Thanks.
Sure thing.
Carol Graham, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She is the author of the forthcoming book and has done a lot of research in this area already, The Pursuit of Happiness Toward an Economy of Well-Being. She's testified in Congress many times and has appeared on NBC News, NPR, NewsHour, CNN, has written for The Wall Street Journal, The Christian Science Monitor, The Financial Times, and The Washington Post. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour. and to Carrie Salinas for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Coming up on Monday, it's All Things Political, which you always hear 1 o'clock on Mondays. Our guest covers the White House and the 2016 presidential election for Bloomberg Politics. We'll be talking more about, of course, the run for the presidency, the debate in the House and the Senate over gun control, Bernie Sanders on his Where We Go From Here rally, which will be taking place tonight. And we invite you to join us for that conversation. And then we'll talk about why everybody is avoiding, not everybody, but near almost a third of the country, people in the country avoid gluten, and yet 1% have medical reasons for doing so. So what's going on with that? Those are our conversations on Monday. We hope you will listen. And thanks very much for participating in this particular hour.